Let's see, by my reckoning, this is the sixth lecture that you people have listened to today and the third after lunch. So I'm not sure whether to call you heroic or just gluttons for punishment, okay? But in any case, you've outperformed the Auburn students by a long way. They don't do such things. This afternoon, I want to talk about the Austrian theory of the business cycle, present a show that sort of takes you through the steps and shows you how it works. It hinges very importantly on capital theory, on interest theory, so I was very attentive to Professor Hulsman's lecture. In fact, before his lecture, I approached him and I asked him if he was going to set me up or dig me a hole to climb out of. And he said, well, he thought he would set me up. And I think he did, more or less. He dug a few little holes that I'll have to work with. But he's done part of my work for me that I'll take advantage of. I have several versions of this show. The one I'm going to use today is one that I used in the summer of 2003 lecturing at the London School of Economics. And I presented a Hayek Memorial Lecture there and discussing these issues with the LSE crowd. And I use this one mainly because it's light on text. I don't have a lot of text in the show because I've found that in presentations of this sort, the text gets in my way. I do battle with the text, and so I'd rather not have much of it. Although if you want to review some of this stuff later on, see other version maybe, if you go to my website, you'll find a version that's loaded with text that almost doesn't need me at all right? You can just sort of pace through it and see the story unfold. Remind you that Friedrich Hayek is the author of Prices and Production. This is some of his early work on monetary theory, business cycle theory, with attention to capital and interest and the effects of money creation on the workings of the economy, and also remind you that the Nobel Prize that was awarded to Hayek in 1974 was awarded partly on the basis of this very work, and cited by the Nobel Committee for pioneering work in the theory of money and economic fluctuations. And it goes on to recognize his other work in political science, penetrating analysis of the interdependence of economic, social, and institutional phenomena. Hayek is probably better known for that last half of the recognition here and lesser known for his work on business cycles. In fact, in the recent literature, several books out on Hayek just in the last several years have been very dismissive of Hayek's business cycle theory, even wondering if it fits in with his the totality of his work. Well, I argue that it does and fits very well. But you'll come across the term technical economics as in Hayek's technical economics. Anytime you see that term, the author is being dismissive of it. That's probably the last thing he'll say about business cycle theory and then go on with the social theory that followed Hayek's road to serfdom and all that. But what I'm focusing on this afternoon is precisely the technical economics and his business cycle theory. So I'll get kind of analytical, but I hope this crowd will warm up to that. We'll see. He was awarded a Nobel Prize for his work in business cycle theory, but of course the theory itself came originally from Ludwig von Mises. And I'll show you a snippet of that, one of my favorite pictures of von Mises there. And Mises wrote about this theory as early as 1912 in his theory of money and credit. And what I'll ask you to notice here is how classical Mises' wording sounds. He talks about the subsistence fund and the period of production. So look what he says. The period of production must be of such a length that exactly the whole available subsistence fund, and of course by subsistence fund he just means the fish, to use Guido Hulsman's example, that will sustain the workers until the capital is ready to yield an output of its own. So until the subsistence fund is necessary on one hand and sufficient on the other for paying the wages of the labor throughout the duration of the productive process. There's a lot packed into that statement, and implicit in it is actually the setup for the theory of business cycles. If public policy and precisely central bank policy causes the duration to be longer than the workers can be sustained, then we get a boom followed by a bust. In other words, a crisis where workers can't be sustained. They run out of fish, okay, before the capital restructuring is completed. That's the essence of the business cycle theory, and is packed into Mises' theory of money and credit in just a two- or three-page account near the end of that book. And that's what Hayek picked up on and wrote several books and articles about the theory of the business cycle. One of the things I like to credit Hayek and the Austrians in general for is this methodological point. And Hayek says, I'm paraphrasing here, before we can meaningfully ask what might go wrong, such as what, inflation, unemployment, business cycles, and all the rest, we should first understand how things could ever go right. Okay? I know we have a few physicians in the room, medical doctors of one sort or another, and they usually warm up to this. You have to know how those organs are supposed to work before you can have a chance at telling how one of them is working wrong. Okay? And it seems like a simple point, and one that's once stated is accepted without question. And yet the Austrians are unique in this regard in their theory of business cycles. As we'll see shortly, Keynes' view of business cycles did not allow the economy to work right at all. There was no way for the economy to work. He never understood how it could work right because he never believed it would work right. There was nothing there to understand. In some correspondence I had recently with David Laidler, who is a monetarist, I pointed out that Keynes never gave us an account about how things could possibly work right. And Laidler wrote back and he said, well, if so, he's in good company. Nobody gives an account of how things could possibly work right. They always go wrong. So Hayek and the Austrians are unique in this sense. Now, one of the ways that we can get at the idea of how things work right is that production possibilities frontier that Guido presented, and here I'll make use of what he's already told you and can give you a fairly short treatment. I'll ask you to observe. I don't think this will be a problem, but I'm reversing the axis. I have consumption on the vertical axis and investment goods or capital goods on the horizontal axis. That's fine. That suits my purposes. Guido can draw it the other way and be equally right for his purposes. And let me just draw a production possibilities frontier. It looks like that. You've seen it in Guido's lecture. We can imagine the economy at full employment, maybe on the frontier at that point. And let me be a little more explicit by what I mean by full employment. As any of you who have taken even the basic courses in macroeconomics realize, full employment doesn't mean literally 100% employment, or it doesn't mean 0% unemployment. All right? It allows for a certain measure of unemployment, sometimes called frictional unemployment. Mises called it speculative unemployment. You might not take a job because you speculate. If you look a little longer, you'll find a better one. Estimates vary, but somewhere around 4 or 5%. We used to say 5 or 6%. It's not chiseled in stone, but it stays in those low single digits for long periods of time. Okay, so when I draw the PPF and show the economy in it, I don't literally, or show the economy on the frontier, I don't literally mean 0% unemployment, but possibly 4, 5, or 6% unemployment. Similarly, the PPF itself, defined for a macroeconomic context, means a combination of consumption goods and investment goods that can be produced on a sustainable level, that year after year you could produce that level that is represented by the orange dot. And the reason I emphasize sustainable levels is to suggest that it's possible to push the economy beyond the frontier, but only temporarily. You can produce at unsustainable levels. That would be slightly beyond the frontier. It won't last, okay? You can push it. The modern phrase is the economy is overheated, okay? And I take that to mean it's been pushed beyond where it can produce on a sustainable basis, right? And even if that can't be produced, pushed far beyond, you can't push it to double the output of consumption and investment goods, but maybe push the economy to grow a little faster than is possible on a sustainable basis. Now, interesting enough, just with this one simple diagram, we can show a sharp divide between Keynes and Hayek. Hayek took the production possibilities frontier seriously, and especially that second P, production possibilities frontier. Even to call it by that name is to suggest that it's possible, isn't it? Should be possible to produce different combinations, other combinations. It should be possible for the economy to move along the frontier, either towards more consumption at the expense of investment or more investment at the expense of consumption. Keynes, as we'll see briefly in this lecture and in a more detailed way in a subsequent lecture that I'm scheduled to give, we'll see that Keynes simply denied that. He denied any possibility of the economy moving along the frontier, and any movement that there might be would be away from the frontier, either inside it, giving us unemployment, or beyond it, giving us inflation. And further, he pointed out, or he argued, that if the economy is sitting on the frontier, it's only by chance. You should be so lucky. And if you are that lucky, your luck won't hold, because the economy is likely to collapse into the interior of the frontier. In other words, he had no way, no mechanism, no conception of how the economy could actually work, okay? Because it always worked perversely. Any kind of change in market conditions would likely cause the economy to crash, or if not crash, to move upward in some inflationary spiral. So the key question then that separates Hayek and Keynes, as I'm presenting it here, is can the economy move along the frontier? Okay, and we have a test right here. We can see if it can. Okay, Keynes says no. Okay, he's got it inside the frontier. Actually, in this portrayal, I've got a hollow point suggesting that's a disequilibrium. It's possible, as I indicated earlier, for the economy to be pushed beyond the frontier, but that's a hollow point too. That's unsustainable. It's disequilibrium, okay? But normally it's on the frontier. Now, can the economy move along the frontier? Well, watch it. Yeah, it can, see? We can end the lecture right here. We've shown the case, okay? It can move along the frontier. And that doesn't look too phenomenal. I mean, of course it can. Can it? I mean, that's why we draw a frontier and see. Talk about different points along it like Guido Hulsman did. But boy, it's important to realize that Keynes denied it. In fact, there he is, okay? That's John Maynard Keynes. And here's the way he denied it. This is directly from the general theory. And look how dramatic this statement is and how unqualified. Every attempt to save more by reducing consumption, how else would you save, will so affect incomes that the attempt necessarily defeats itself. That's his paradox of thrift, isn't it? And so for Keynes, if you just happen by accident to be on the frontier, well, watch out. What if people start saving? What'll that do? Will it move you along the frontier? No, not in Keynes' view. It'll move you inside the frontier and possibly deep inside the frontier. And notice those are solid points because Keynes thought those were other equilibria. He called them unemployment equilibrium. All right? It might move back, you know, and in fact, it might even push beyond the frontier in an inflationary spiral. Right? And only by accident is it setting on the frontier. So here we have two opposing views of how the economy works. Hayek showing how it can work by moving along the frontier. Keynes showing that the only possible movement is either inside or beyond the frontier. All right? Yes?
In what sense does Keynes believe that it will defeat itself in the line of saving recent consumption?
Now, I'm sorry, in what sense does Keynes believe?
Yeah, what effect on income does Keynes believe that reducing consumption will have? What negative effect?
Oh, it'll reduce income as well. In other words, as we'll see later, and possibly in a later lecture, with Keynes, if one thing gets reduced, everything gets reduced. There aren't any relative movements. They might be reduced at different speeds. But increased saving means decreased consumption, decreased spending general, decreased income, spiraling downwards, okay? So everything goes negative at once or everything goes positive. There's never any relative shifts. That's sort of unique to Keynes. That's what makes it Keynesian theory. Yes, aggregate demand, as the Keynesians would say, would go down. That's his paradox of thrift. Okay. Now, Hayek realized that the key to disproving Keynes lay in capital theory, which is what Guido talked about in the last lecture. And he set about, after the general theory was written, to write a book on capital theory that would prove the case. And he eventually did publish in 1941 The Pure Theory of Capital, his absolute least successful book, least read book. And part of the reason that it's not read is because his view of capital in that book is so complex that people had trouble understanding it. But he thought it was the absolute proof against Keynes. I'm going to suggest otherwise, that if we go back to prices and production, we get an adequate view of the capital structure that allows us to deal with Keynes. Out of one of Lanny Ebenstein's books, he had interviewed one of the LSE students, and one of the students in the 30s recalls the three-dimensional diagrams which Hayek presented his ideas and which made them seem something like in the field of engineering. And I've brought one of those with me today. There it is. That's the intertemporal capital structure, straight out of the pure theory of capital. And I could, if I wanted, spend the rest of this lecture explaining just what that diagram means, okay? But I'm not going to do it. Instead, I'm going to suggest that Hayek went off on the wrong track, at least strategically, in this sense, and he would have been much better off with the simple Hayekian triangle that he introduced in prices and production. So I'm going to clean this up and just make it a triangle, okay? Simplify. Now, let's see. Do I have a light here of some kind? No, it doesn't work very well because I've got lots of light on the screen. But you can see what this is. I have reoriented Hayek's triangle just to make it more readable. You go from left to right in stages of production, and that vertical side at the end is the consumable output yielded by the stages of production. So count them. I've got about five stages there, starting with early stage stuff. It could be extraction industries, and goes through manufacturing and retailing, distributing, retailing, and finally sales to the consumer. You could use any kind of an example to explain the stages. The stages have two distinct and complementary understandings. One is process through time, with goods in process moving from one stage to another, eventually yielding consumer goods. The second conception that's complementary to it is that at any given point in time, things are going on in all the stages. So they exist simultaneously, such that you can transfer resources from one to the other without involving time travel. Okay, people can quit working at retail shops and start working in the mining industry, and they move from a late stage to an early stage without traveling backward in time. So the stages exist simultaneously, while at the same time, those extraction industries will be producing consumer goods in the remote future. Okay, you could think in terms of something like hog farming, okay, and look at the stages. You need some eventual consumer output, but in the stages, you know, you build the hog pen, you get the baby hogs, you raise the hogs, you send them to the butcher, you send them to the retailer, and eventually get something out of it that's actually consumable. Okay, that's the way it works. And all those things are going on, though, at the same time. Now, Hayek insists that we have to begin our analysis with a properly functioning market economy. And the way I'm going to show the properly functioning market economy, I'll show it in equilibrium at full employment. And one aspect of the equilibrium is something that was called back in the 30s. It was given its name back then. I didn't give it its name, okay? But it's called the loanable funds market. And Professor Helsman was a little bit critical of the loanable funds market, as Murray Rothbard is in Man, Economy, and State. But it deserves criticism if what's meant is a very narrowly defined producer's loan market. In fact, that's the term that Rothbard used, the producer's loan market, saying that it's trivial in comparison with the broad application of interest rate theory to a market economy. Well, I'm here to tell you that my graph is the broad application, okay? So this is the loanable funds market broadly defined. So I've got the interest rate on the vertical axis, and then separately investment and saving on the horizontal axis. And look how it works. There's a supply of loanable funds that's saving. It just means that the higher interest that financial institutions are willing to pay you, the more you're willing to save. All right? There's the demand for loanable funds. That's the business community borrowing those funds in order to pay workers who can then buy fish until the production process is finished. So that's the demand for loans on the part of the investment community. Now, I realize there's consumer loans, too, but we're abstracting from those. In fact, the way you do it is that that supply of loanable funds is a net supply. In other words, we as income earners and savers may lend money back and forth to one another for consumption loans, but the issue is how much do we collectively as income earners and savers make available to the investment community for buying capital goods and paying workers and all that, okay? That's what that diagram shows. And it shows it in equilibrium at 5% interest, and it's a macro figure, probably 800 billion is a macro magnitude for the level of investment and the level of saving. Even in the Austrian theory, saving equal investment in equilibrium, that's a commonality with almost any macro theory, including Keynes. And now all we have to do is put back in our production possibilities frontier to complete the story or to get it closer to completion. Look, if the economy is producing 800 worth of investment goods and it's at full employment because the economy is working properly, then we can see how much it can produce in the way of consumer goods, okay? And realize that that consumption, as measured there on the vertical axis of the PPF, is exactly the same as the consumption that's the final output of that structure of production. All right? So that's the setup. I mean, that shows you how everything's working together to give you an economy that's working right. So equilibrium is defined, look at the orange dot there, in terms of the loanable funds market, in terms of the production possibilities frontier, and in terms of the distribution of resources among the different stages of production to maintain that particular output consistent with the PPF. The only thing lacking here is some notion of the labor market. Okay, how about people supplying and demanding labor? And here a critical Austrian point is it just won't do to talk about the labor market, because the labor markets in different stages react differently depending on what happens to the interest rate. A rising interest rate or a falling interest rate will allocate labor from one stage to another, so they can't be working the same. We need stage-specific labor markets. I've got five stages. I could put up five labor markets. I'm just going to put up two, pull them down there in little spotlights, and show supply and demand for labor as equilibrated by the real wage, W over P. And so equilibrium is defined also in terms of the labor markets, plural. Okay? Now, we could imagine that this is an economy, and here again I'm picking up on Guido Holzman's lecture. This is an economy in which capital depreciation is 800. That it takes 800 in investment just to maintain the capital structure intact. Just to keep the PPF from collapsing. And 800 won't cause it to expand. Okay? We could conceive of it that way, and if you conceive of it that way, then there the economy sets. It's going to look like that next year and the following year as well. But the more interesting case is the case where capital depreciation is something less than 800. Let's say 600. Okay? Suppose capital depreciation is 600. It only takes 600 to keep capital intact. And so we got 200 that's adding to the capital stock each year, which means the PPF shifts outward. So too do the supply and demand for loanable funds. Supply shifts outward because people are earning more and therefore they're saving more. Demand shifts outward because there's more capital to maintain and entrepreneurs are tooling up to produce for a later day when there'll be even increased income. Yes?
Are you saying in the next cycle this will happen?
Yeah. No? Yeah. So period after period. Okay. If the interest rate doesn't change, and it might not, we'll show that it probably will, but let's start out with the idea it might not change because supply and demand shift out at the same rate. Then the triangle gets larger too, but it doesn't change its shape. See that the hypotenuse of the triangle represents the price spreads between the stages. That's one of the key aspects of interest that Professor Holzman mentioned. And that needs to be consistent with the level of interest shown in the loanable funds market. All right? So this economy will grow. In fact, we say watch it grow. Okay? Listen to it grow. Okay? There goes that sucker. It's growing. Okay? That's what economic growth looks like in the Austrian view. Now, what Hayek said about Keynes, he said that Keynes's aggregates conceal the most fundamental mechanisms of change. Because Keynes argues in terms of the labor market. He argues in terms of total spending, whether it's on consumption or investment, total employment, total income. He's got such a high level of aggregation that he can't see what's going on within it to change the relative magnitudes and cause the economy to do one thing or another. And Hayek insists that you got to disaggregate, you got to work at a lower level of aggregation if you want to see the market mechanisms that actually allow the economy to change, to grow, to move along the frontier. And it goes like this. Suppose people decide to save more. And I don't need to be apologetic by supposing that, although Keynes has had such an enormous impact that I almost have to explain why in the world people would decide to save more. See, Keynes says that won't happen. People are creatures of habit. They save out of a given income a certain amount, and that's it. They don't just decide to save more. That's wrong, of course. They might decide to save more for their children's education, which they decide is more important than they once thought, for travel after they retire, for subsistence once they see what's happening to Social Security. Okay, there's all sorts of reasons why people might decide to save more. And that's shown as a shift of that supply curve to the left, supply of loanable funds. And you can see what it does. It drives the interest rate down, looks like to about 2.3, and increases both saving and investment. All right? Surely that could happen. You get a new equilibrium there. Let's look upstairs and see what's going on. Well, these are precisely the mechanisms that will cause the economy to move along that frontier. You see, Keynes's paradox of thrift said if people save more, the economy spirals into the frontier. And Hayek is saying, no, it moves along the frontier because lower interest means greater investment. Okay? And that gives you a new point on the frontier. Now let's look at what's going on with the triangle. And there's two things going on. One is that there's less demand for resources at those late stages because people have cut down on spending. They're saving. So, yes, there's less demand. In fact, Keynes thought that was the whole story. Yes, less demand there and less demand everywhere else too. That's how the whole economy sinks. But Hayek says, well, you're neglecting the interest rate effect, because at low interest rate, investors are inspired to invest more. Okay? And so at the early stages, you get greater levels of investment. And that investment is not going to serve the current people who are saving now. It's going to serve people in the future who are going to have higher incomes and some saved up funds to spend. One point I like to make in class, and I make in my book, is that people don't just save for fun. It's not fun. Okay? People save up for something, and sometimes I abbreviate SUFS, save up for something. And there are profits to be made by entrepreneurs who can command the resources that are freed up by the current saving to produce things that these people are willing and able to buy in the future with their saved up funds. That's what entrepreneurship is all about. So you get a differential effect in the Hayekian triangle, something that Keynes neglected explicitly. In chapter 4 of the general theory, Keynes says we assume throughout a fixed structure of industry. Well, if you assume that, then you've put the mechanisms of change in a straitjacket. Okay? So the Hayekian triangle gets longer in the horizontal dimension. In other words, more stages of production, resources tied up for a longer period of time, greater level of roundaboutness, a term you've heard, even though less consumption, at least in the current period, when people are saving. Look at the labor markets, and here's why we have to have more than one labor market. And we see that in the labor markets, well, you can guess what's going on. The demand for labor in the late stages is going to fall. If people are saving, they're not buying, why have so many clerks in the store to sell? Okay, you might lay off some. And yet, in the early stages, where low interest rate is stimulating investment, there's an increase in demand for labor to engage in the investment activity. So you have differential effects in the labor market. In fact, that's precisely what moves the labor out of the late stages, which aren't so much in demand now, and into early stages where there is demand. To make that point a little more vividly, let me just show you, blown up a little bit, the supply and demand for labor. So let's compare the labor markets in the late stages of production with labor markets in the early stages. One late stage might be inventory management, okay? Not a glamorous job, okay? Not a difficult job. Somebody's got to do it, you know? Should be able to do it well and peek in on an inventory manager. He's got it knocked, okay? He's got it done. Lacking customers, I don't see any customers. And why? Well, they're saving. Okay? They're saving. And if they save, that means they're going to have purchasing power in the future to buy something. Well, aren't there entrepreneurs around who are willing to do some experimentation, do some product development, and find something that these people are likely to buy? So product development might be the early stage. It's a harder job. Okay? It takes a little ingenuity. Those consumer goods aren't going to be ready for a long time, okay? But this is the early stage. So this is the kind of differential activity we ought to see. How would these two labor markets be affected by an increase in saving? Well, you've seen it already. Remember that S in the capital-based framework is better understood as save up for something. So you get that decrease in demand in the late stages and an increase in demand in the early stages. That's something that's not possible at all in a Keynesian framework. Yeah.
Is there an assumption of a homogeneous worker?
No, at all. Not at all. All there is the notion that all adjustments are made at the margin. Okay. It doesn't need to be that every worker is equally capable of every job. Okay. But as in microeconomics generally, all adjustments are made at the margin, and there might be people. We're out looking for a job, and they put in their application at Sears, and they also put in their application at the 3M company. They're willing to work either place. And under these circumstances, they're more likely to get a job at 3M than they are at Sears. Okay? Okay. So look what that means. Now, see, translate it back to the stages of production. You get contraction in the late stages and expansion in the early stages. And the new triangle then has a less steep slope, which actually goes along with a lower interest rate. Isn't that right? All right. Now, let me set this thing up. And the trick here, as I'm sort of taking you through the paces to show you how the economy responds to an increase in saving, I've done it step by step. And now I want to just do it all at once so you can see it all at once and have an appreciation for how the market responds to an increase in savings. So just watch it. I might do it twice. Okay, there it works. It responds smoothly. Okay, the market works. If you let it work, felt so good. Let's do it again. There it goes. Okay. Okay, now watch the economy grow. See, now we've shifted, we've moved along that production possibilities frontier, so we got more investment to start with, and the economy is going to grow faster. So watch it grow now, and you hear it goes, it's growing at a faster rate, okay? Like so. In fact, there in a nutshell are the two possible growth rates before the increase in saving. Look at the orange dots. The economy was growing like that. But if you had savings first, it'd grow faster, so that it looks like in about three periods, people are consuming more than they would have been able to consume had they not initially saved. Well, that's what saving is all about, isn't it? You tighten up your belt now in order to be able to consume more sometime in the future. That's the way it works. Okay? Now, here's a couple of things from Hayek in two different books where finally we're introducing money into the system. Money by its very nature constitutes a kind of a loose joint in a self-equilibrating apparatus of the price mechanism. So I showed that saving sequence operate very smoothly. And yet, if money is in play, if you have a manipulation of the money supply, it might not be so smooth. Okay? It might have a few missteps in there. Here is where Hayek was very critical of Keynes. He says there's no justification for ignoring this loose joint, much less in making the political hay on the basis of the loose joint. In other words, don't make the economy grow faster than can be sustained just because you can get away with it for a short period, as in between now and the next election. And then he says the task of monetary theory is nothing less than to cover a second time the whole field, which is treated by the pure theory under the assumption of barter. So he's showing you the difference between price theory generally and monetary theory. And what's unique about this next sequence of slides, and I want to emphasize the uniqueness, is that before, I've just got a whole economy with lots of entrepreneurs. We don't need to give their names. Lots of workers, don't need to name them. Each doing their own thing, each adjusting at the margin as best he sees fit. And that gives rise to a certain pattern of investment. But when you got money in play, and when you got a central bank, you do have one unique individual whose name we all know, who can make his own decisions that affect the interest rate. He meets eight times a year or so to decide what will they do to the interest rate now. Okay? So this unique individual comes into play in a fairly dramatic way. There he is, looking on and making the decision on what basis, it's hard to say, that the interest rate is too high. Okay? Does it look too high to you? Okay? The interest rate is too high. The economy would do better if only the interest rate were lower. The economy would grow faster if the interest rate were lower. Okay? We need a stimulant package, right? That's what it's all about, stimulate the economy. Sometimes they say accommodate growth. They accommodate a little more growth than can be sustained is what happens. Okay. So look at the similarities here. If Greenspan steps in and increases the money supply, and think about how he does that. If you've taken money in banking course, you learn three different ways that the Fed can increase the money supply. And you better not get them mixed up on the exam, okay? Because they can engage in open market operations, buying treasury bills from big New York City banks and bond dealers. Or they can change the reserve ratio so that banks will have more reserves to lend. Or they can change the discount rate, now called, it has a different name now.
Federal funds?
No, it's called primary credit, the primary credit rate. Federal funds rate is the rate they target in their open market operations. See? You can miss a point on the test there. Okay. Change the primary credit rate so that banks will borrow more directly from the Fed and lend it. And what's really important here, as you're learning the three different ways, is that they're all the same in a critical respect. They're all money lent into existence. Money is lent into existence. It has its first impact on the interest rate. Okay? So let's show the money being lent into existence, and we don't even have to specify which of those three policy tools it used, because any one of them is going to lower the interest rate. And I've sized it in such a way, calibrated my graphics, so that he's pumped up the money supply by the same amount as there was genuine savings in the earlier sequence. But now there's no genuine savings here. People haven't decided to save more. It's just that more money has been pumped in the system. The interest rate has dropped. Well, the business community is going to respond to those low interest rates in much the same way that they would if the interest rate were caused by an increase in saving. How many businessmen and businesswomen read prices and production? They just don't do it, okay? And they hear the interest rate is low, and they want to borrow more money. That's the way it works. But look at the consequences. The way I like to say it is that pumping money through credit markets drives a wedge between saving and investment. And it causes savers actually to save less. Their saving preferences haven't changed, and now they're getting less interest for their money, so they move down along that supply curve. But the business community is borrowing more. How can the business community be borrowing more when there's less to borrow? Well, there's less saving to borrow, but there's money from the Fed to borrow. Okay, so the saving plus the money from the Fed, which is really that horizontal distance between the two arrowheads, that's the money that gets lent into existence and lent to business people who are engaging in long-term production activities. Okay. We can see it upstairs here. You get a double disequilibrium, okay? You get savers saving less and investors investing more. Let's look upstairs. If you say that people are saving less, that means they're consuming more, okay? Out of a given income, if you don't save as much as you did before, you're spending more. You're consuming more. And yet investors are investing more, too. So look what that does. That gives you a double disequilibrium upstairs. I call this a tug of war between the consumers and the investors. Investors want to pull more resources into investment because the interest rate is cheap. Consumers want to pull more resources into consumption because the interest rate is cheap. Okay? They don't want to lend that much at those low rates of interest. And the resultant of that is a disequilibrium outside the PPF. In other words, an overheated economy. The economy is being pushed beyond the frontier, which is possible, certainly. We've seen it during those second term of the Clinton administration, for starters, with the unemployment rate being driven down as low as 3.9%. Okay? So we've been pushed beyond the frontier. Now, this is where the political hay is made. In other words, to the average voter who sees a booming economy, he associates it with the administration in power. He doesn't know anything about Hayek. Okay? And certainly the administration is there to take credit. Look how well the economy's doing. You know? Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And if you look at the triangle, what you see is that the triangle is being stretched at both ends against the middle. And this is an interpretation that you get out of one set of Austrians, but not out of another, but it's the one I like to go with it because it's consistent with the rest of the graphics. Because you have both more consumption and at the same time more early stage investment. Mises used the expression overconsumption and malinvestment. Okay? More consumption because people are saving less, and malinvestment meaning the resources that are being invested are invested in projects that are too long-term. So you're eating more seed corn while at the same time you're planting seeds of things that won't grow for another 5 or 10 years. Okay, so it's is a situation that can come to no good end, but during the early phases of it, it looks good, and you can harvest the votes. The politicians can harvest the votes off of that kind of policy. So you get actually increased consumption, increased early stage, and a hollowing out is a term that I've heard lately from Sean Corrigan, who writes Capital Insight, a hollowing out of the middling stages. You get the triangle pulled from both ends against the middle. One of the economists I like that developed this view is Richard Striegel, who wrote back in the 30s, just a couple of years after Hayek had written Prices and Production. And the way he put it, he says, think of the economy as divided into three sectors. One sector, you're just pumping consumer goods out the front door. Another sector is we're maintaining the capital structure. And the third sector is venture capital, more projects, longer-term projects. And he says under favorable credit conditions brought about by central bank policy, you get an emphasis on pumping the goods out the front door and venture capital at the expense of maintaining the existing capital. All right? All which eventually comes to no good end, a crisis and a bust. So that's another way of looking at it. Okay? So that's the way the structure of production changes. In other words, it's at war with itself. It's not internally consistent. And as you can see, the middling stages, once they work their way up through the consumption stage, they're going to be yielding less consumption goods and not more. That's the forced savings that some of the Austrians write about. Yeah.
What are the units of the X and Y axis on the?
I was hoping nobody would ask that, but I'll answer the question anyhow. For the triangle, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. The units on the vertical axis are just is real consumption. Okay, real consumption. On the horizontal axis, that's where all the thorny issues of capital are. And it's a measure of the extent to which resources are tied up in the production process. The Austrians and the old Swedish economists measured it in dollar years or pound years if you're using pound sterling. Okay, so it's a complex unit of so many dollars tied up for so long a time, which is consistent with the loan market. When you borrow money, you pay interest on the basis of so many dollars for a certain amount of time.
So it's not investment?
No, investment is measured here in the loanable funds market. That's just the total real investment. But the triangle is trying to give some indication of roundaboutness is what it's measuring. The extent to which those investable resources are tied up in the production process for a period of time. Okay. That's the briefest answer I could get. And if I gave a more complex answer, I would expose all those thorny issues. Okay. So, now I've just grayed out two of those diagrams because I'm not going to try to track what's going on here. But you can see what's going to go on here. You're going to push the economy beyond the frontier, and yet it's going to come back in your face. In other words, it can't be sustained. The subsistence fund isn't great enough to carry the workers through until the capital restructuring is completed. And so at first you get an increase in consumption and then a decrease in consumption. And then business people begin to get a sense of how disoriented the economy is, how conflicted the economy is. They begin to lose confidence in the economy. They hold back on their investment decisions. And the economy sinks well into the frontier. It's interesting here that you see that arrow going well deep into the frontier. Hayek called that the secondary contraction. In other words, the primary problem is this pushing beyond the frontier, which has to come to no good end. But after that, things can get out of hand and the economy can spiral down. That's the only aspect that Keynes saw, the spiraling down. And he thought that was just inherent in the nature of the market process. He thought markets just collapse sometimes. Okay? And Hayek says, no, they don't just collapse sometimes, but if you try to make them grow faster than is possible for them to grow, you'll create a crisis out of which a collapse is surely possible. Okay? And so the movement you see is into the interior, but not to equilibrium, but it's a very much of a intertemporal disequilibrium. Okay, now once again, I'll clean up my picture, and now I'll show you the whole business cycle in just two clicks of the remote here. So watch it carefully. You see the whole business cycle unfolding, and it looks like this. All right. After which, yes.
Well, want to go back? Want to do that again? Because when what was invested in the early stages catches up.
Yeah. All right. After which, nothing to do but survey the damage. You know something's wrong. Not sure what. No, as Curious George, he's always looking, you know, to figure it out. And at this point, I mean, this sums up Greenspan's position once the downturn got underway. He didn't know what to do. I mean, what's he supposed to do? He doesn't know what to do. The economy's been discoordinated intertemporally. The market's trying to work things out. Is there anything he can do to fix things now? I don't think so. Okay. And it's not a happy situation for anybody except maybe. Okay. The last sequence here needs no narration except don't grow the economy. That's bad English and it's bad economics. Just let the economy grow at its own rate, okay? It grows like that. Thank you. Thank you. We'll do a few questions.
Yeah.
You got time for questions? Yes, sir.
I was wondering, did you say that
move beyond it?
Yeah.
When Keynes wrote about that, it was only in nominal terms. In other words, for Keynes, the PPF serves only as a dividing line between the problem of unemployment and the problem of inflation.
Right. So how would you have then explained for the huge increase in production that came through from the Industrial Revolution?
Well, he would allow for economic growth over time and, in fact, even allow for the economy to grow faster with the help of the monetary authority because he didn't see the dangers in creating an unsustainable boom. So he certainly saw that. That's
the direct move on the outward?
Yeah, but here we're talking about the economy moving beyond the frontier as opposed to the frontier itself actually shifting outward.
Okay.
So he certainly allowed for the economy to shift out. In allowing the economy to go beyond the frontier, only in nominal terms, and that's inflation. Okay, that's the way you set it up. I mean, you've heard it, you read it in your textbooks that in Keynesian economics you can have the problem of inflation or the problem of unemployment, but not both. And the PPF is the dividing line between the two. Okay, yeah.
Yes, sir. What are the institutional and legal changes necessary to prevent this whole process?
Well, you get different answers from different Austrians here, but what I would emphasize would be decentralization of the banking system. Okay, I think as long as you have a central bank which meets and decides what the interest rate will be, you're going to be in trouble. I read a speech by one of the bank presidents. In fact, it's the only bank president I actually know at the Kansas City Fed. Years ago, 1973, Tom Honig and I were both rookies at the Kansas City Fed. We both, should I confess that I worked for the Fed? No. We were both working for the Kansas City Fed. And he went on to be president, okay? And I ended up in Alabama. Well, that's the way it works. But in any case, he gave a speech. It was actually a pretty good speech, I thought. A few months ago, and he said that the discussion for the future, and of course, as the president of the Fed, he's also a member of the Federal Open Market Committee that meets in Washington and decides, along with Greenspan, what to do with interest rates. He says, what we have to discuss is where is the natural rate of interest and how quickly we want to adjust the economy to that rate. Okay? And of course, if you think about it, you realize that the reason they don't know where the natural rate of interest is because they've been manipulating the interest rate for 80 years. Okay?
So is it necessary to get rid of fractional reserve banking altogether?
Well, that's where you get a big difference, and you'll get some Austrians saying yes and others saying no. And Mises himself would emphasize two points. If you have a system that has centralized banking and fractional reserve, you're in trouble. Okay, I've come to believe that if you can get rid of the centralization, the fractional reserve is not going to be a worrisome problem. Others will give you different opinions on that, because if you have a decentralized banking system, then a bank engaging in expansion is more likely to do itself in than to do the economy in. That's the nature of decentralization.
But if, right? A lot of the banks are doing themselves in, would it not in turn do the economy in?
No, I don't think it would. And it's a good question, because it actually resolves itself into the issue of whether banks in trouble or bank runs tend to be contagious, okay? And some of the popular history is that bank runs are such a bad thing because it's so contagious. If there's a run on one bank, there'll be a run on a lot of banks. But I think that's only true when you have a highly regulated banking system where they're all doing about the same thing. But if you have a competitive banking system, a decentralized banking system, where each bank is catering to different kinds of customers and doing different things, then if one bank is failing, people withdraw that money from that bank and put it in a different bank that operates differently. And so you don't get the whole system falling. You just get a shuffling of funds from one bank to another. So under the right conditions, bank runs and other bank problems tend not to be contagious. Okay? Yes.
You said at the beginning that mainstream economists have discounted Hayek.
Well, that's pretty much true.
Today, presumably they have discounted Keynes, or maybe they haven't, but if we presume they have, then what is the argument against Hayek in a specific way?
Uh-huh. It's a good question, and I'm probably not the one to ask that, because I ask that question myself a lot. I'm not the one to answer that. I ask that question myself a lot, and in fact, there are a lot of Keynesians today. The only difference is they're what I call them adjectival Keynesians. No one is just a Keynesian. They're a new Keynesian or a post-Keynesian, or it goes on. There are lots of different adjectives. What kind of Keynesian are you? Okay. And they do battle with one another a lot. But Keynes is not dead in academic circles. Very much alive. It's not that they have an argument against Hayek. They just don't know what Hayek's argument is. Okay? They just don't know. That's all there is to it. Yeah?
I was hoping to get a clarification on the contraction at the end, because that kind of lost me in terms of the logical argument as to why that would have to occur. And one of the reasons I question it is because of the existence of forced savings, which is another thing that you mentioned that I thought you'd go into a little more detail about. So the process begins with the credit extension.
Right.
And so that lowers the interest rate, and that stimulates investment, and that stimulates consumption, but only nominal consumption, right? Because now
it stimulates real consumption.
Because of the credit extension, people are spending more on consumption because of the price change.
It's stimulating real consumption, and in fact this is one of the things that Mises pointed out early, that he says this long-term investment can't be seen through to completion, especially if people are consuming at a greater rate than they ordinarily would because of the low interest rates. In other words,
but are they, though? Because you brought up the question of forced savings, and I wonder why is that not applicable?
Well,
why are they not forced to save less because of the price level?
Well, eventually they are. In other words, if you see that triangle is being pulled at both ends against the middle, then those middling stages are the ones that that have a reduction in resources allocated to them. When they get up to the consumption level, then you're going to have some reduction, some forced reduction in consumption. And that's the crisis. And that's part of the crisis. Later in the week, I think maybe Wednesday, I'm going to give a lecture that will deal at length with overconsumption and forced saving in the context of the business cycle. But and one thing that I'll warn you about is that the term forced saving has a lot of different meanings, even among the Austrians, and we'll try to sort out just what it's supposed to mean and what it doesn't mean.
Okay, Roger, we're out of time.
Thank you. Thank you.